You're listening to 90.7 WGXC ACRA. And in this hour, I will have Bonnie St. John on the line with me. And if you missed me talking about her in the first hour, so Bonnie St. John, she became the first African-American to win Olympic medals in ski racing, silver and two bronze medals in downhill events at the 1984 Paralympics. She graduated magna cum laude from Harvard University and won a Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford. And aside from that, she's just a pretty fantastic human being. So we are here this morning with Bonnie St. John. Are you there, Bonnie?
I'm here. I'm very excited to be here.
I am excited to have you here. So Bonnie St. John, so Bonnie became the first African-American to win Olympic medals in ski racing, silver and two bronze medals in downhill events at the 1984 Paralympics. And you graduated magna cum laude from Harvard University, right?
Right.
And
yeah.
Won a Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford and was appointed by President Clinton to the White House National Economic Council. So I think it's fantastic that you're able to be on the line with us this morning, with me this morning. So thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to do this.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's fun to talk with you, Michelle.
So, and you guys, and Bonnie is also just a fantastic human being. You know, sometimes you meet people and, you know, they've done a bunch of stuff and they're a little bit like disconnected, I feel like, from reality. But Bonnie's not that person. So thank you just for just being connected, which is so important.
Thank you.
Now, Bonnie, you have overcome some pretty huge obstacles in life. You've got a really amazing story, and your leg was amputated when you were five, and then you were abused by one of your stepfathers. And I know.
I know we're gonna dig right into this.
I know, right?
Let's go for it.
We just go right to it.
Yeah, no, I had a birth defect in my right leg, and so from the time I was born, you know, I had braces and orthopedic shoes. They amputated my leg when I was five. I was in and out of hospitals with surgeries all through my childhood. My father left before I was born. My mother married an abusive stepfather when I was about two. And was abused for many years, sexually abused by my stepfather. So a lot of crazy things. I mean, some people looked at my childhood, you know, and said, "Wow, you should be an axe murderer."
Oh my goodness!
And so people ask, you know, how is it you're smiling? You know, how is it you're coping? So you asked, how do you get through all those challenges? And for me, I look back, I was so shut down as a child. I learned to not care for myself or my emotions. I really shut down. I did also turn very much to God. I was going to Sunday school. I would read the Bible. I prayed a lot, and I really leaned heavily on God. But like so many of us, as a teenager, I really turned away. So as a teenager, I decided I can do this better. Don't need God.
Yeah.
God just hasn't done enough for me. So I'm going to do this on my own. So I really turned away and tried to do it on my own terms for many years. And when I had my daughter and she was the same age as I was when I was abused, I started to lose my mind. And at first I didn't even know why.
Right.
I would have wanted to just go drink or to run around or, you know, like to medicate the pain. And I didn't even understand where the pain was coming from at first. It kind of took me a while. And then I really had to deal with my issues. And I really reached a place where I realized I couldn't do it alone. And I was broken and I needed help. So I went back to the church. But it's interesting because sometimes I liken it to the skiing. When I first learned how to ski on one leg, I leaned on outriggers.
Okay.
Do you know what those are? The poles with the little ski tips?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I leaned on them. So it's like they call it three tracking. So it's like you're using three skis, one ski and two outriggers, and you make three tracks in the snow. And it's not a very graceful way of skiing.
Okay.
And then I went and I learned how to ski with, well, actually I wanted to learn how to ski with ski poles. And to do that, I had to learn to ski with nothing in my hands at all. Because when I tried to ski with a ski pole, I would plant the pole and try to lean on it like an outrigger. And if you can, I don't know, if anyone skis, you could imagine if you lean on a ski pole, your arm gets ripped out, you know, because you keep moving and that doesn't. So I couldn't ski on regular ski poles. I learned how to ski with nothing in my hand. So I can ski on one ski with nothing.
Oh my gosh.
It freaks people out. I know.
It's Bonnie, really... I can hardly ski on two skis with the poles. Remind me to tell you my cross country, when I learned a cross country snow ski story at some point.
Well, I'm lucky because my tips never crossed, right?
Right.
But so I learned to ski with nothing, and then I learned to ski with regular ski poles, and then to race, when I made it on the team, they told me I had to go back to outriggers, because with outriggers, you can make a mistake. If something goes wrong, you have something there to catch you, and so you finish more races. So the team is saying, you know, you need to finish races to win, so we need you back on outriggers. So I went back to outriggers. And this time, though, I wasn't leaning on them and making three tracks in the snow. I could hold them up in the air. I could put both outriggers on one side of my body and angulate into the turn, and use them like a counterweight to get more angulation. I could do amazing things with the outriggers, but I still had help. And I just think that's such a great metaphor for the way I got help emotionally with God too, is I started out when I was younger, I was leaning so hard. I was expecting God to fix everything. And I was mad when he didn't. But then I went off on my own and tried to do everything on my own, which strengthened me. And when I finally went back, I realized it's a partnership. God isn't going to do everything for me. And I'm not going to do everything alone. We've got to work together. God has expectations of me as well, that I got to do my part. And I can let God do his part too. Does that make sense?
No, that makes perfectly good sense. You know, there's so many times, I can't tell you the number of times I've talked with people and they said, you know, I was praying for this thing and then God didn't do this. And, you know, but it is a partnership, right? And recognizing that sometimes we're praying for something that's not supposed to happen, or it's happening at a different time, or there's something that we need to do.
Yes.
In the midst of that. So I think that's kind of what I hear you saying.
One of my favorite stories is the pastor's garden, that the pastor's out working in the garden, and a parishioner comes by and says, God has given you such a beautiful garden. And the pastor looks up and says, yes, but you should have seen it when God had it all to himself. You know, we're really expected to do our part.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I had a conversation with another pastor yesterday, and we were talking about that scripture, faith without work is dead. And he was like, no, no, no. And I was like, no, you got to hear me out. I was like, you know, if you need a job and you're sitting at home and all you're doing is praying for a job, but you never put any work into that job search, right? You never talk to anybody. You never send out any resumes. You're just like, well, God is going to do this thing for me. I was like, but you're not doing anything for yourself in the midst of that. Like, it's not going to happen. Yeah. So that is a fantastic story. So what was it? So you are the first African-American to win medals for skiing, to win Olympic medals for skiing.
Actually, you know, we have written that many times, but what we realized relatively recently is I'm actually the first African-American to win any medal in any Winter Olympics, full stop, not just skiing.
Wow. Okay.
So
yeah.
Essence did a whole article, or it was either Essence or Ebony, on blacks in Winter Olympics during the last Olympics, last Winter Olympics. And I was looking at the list of all the names and I realized I was before everybody that won medals. So, and it's funny because they often don't count, because I was in the Paralympics. So I'm a disabled skier. I skied on one leg. So I was on the US team for the disabled. So they often don't say Bonnie was the first because they're not comparing Olympics and Paralympics.
But you know, I personally do triathlons, and you know, I consider myself to be a little bit of a fitness enthusiast. I've seen there are a whole lot of disabled people who work a whole lot harder than I do. let me say that, you know, and I think it's amazing. I mean, when I learned to cross country ski, it was because I had to, because I was doing park ranger work at the time. And they put me on. So yeah, we did ski patrol. So they put me on skis one night, and had me doing laps around the ranger station.
Yeah.
Right. You know, she kind of showed me the basics, had me doing laps around the ranger station while they were all inside, kind of like watching for me out the window.
Yeah.
So they would make sure that I passed the window at certain points and I fell.
Oh,
right.
No.
And I couldn't get up. Right. My feet are all twisted up in these skis and I can't get up. And so finally one of them comes out and they're hollering for me. They're like, Michelle, Michelle. And I'm like, I'm over here. It was like, I've fallen and I can't get up. And I couldn't. And somebody had to come and help me up. So when I say, I think it's amazing, what you do, I think it's pretty amazing. I finally did become adept at cross country skiing. But
I like cross country skiing. I wear my artificial leg when I do cross country skiing and just, it's like hiking, but I love it if it's flat,
mm-hmm.
but if you put me on any kind of a hill, I roll and it's bad because my artificial leg isn't really designed to do that. Anyway, so when I downhill ski, I don't wear the leg at all. I just do one,
mm-hmm.
but for cross country, that wouldn't work very well because you would just kind of stand still. Right.
Right. So you've got a story. Right. You've got a story and a story about when you were at the Olympics, because you've had this quote that you're known for saying. Can we talk about that?
Sure. So I was the third ranked woman in the U.S. when I was selected on the team, which was good because they only took 3 one-legged women on the team. I just barely made it after years of training. And I had trained on a glacier in Oregon for 2 summers. I grew up in San Diego, but I had moved to Vermont. I had trained in Lake Tahoe one winter and it's like my family was rich. I had to raise the money. I was waiting tables. I was doing all kinds of things to make this work with Band-Aids and glue. And so finally made the team. And, you know, it's so funny. I look back, when I went to the Olympics on the team, I was wearing mismatched gloves that I had found in a lost and found somewhere.
Wow.
Nowadays, the Paralympians get all of the stuff that the Olympians get too. So they get like 3 big garbage bags full of clothes, you know, from the
right.
sponsors. But back then, as a Paralympian on the US team, all I got was a jacket and a sweater. So it was on a wing and a prayer. But anyway, so I made the team. And my mother had never actually seen me ski race. We lived in San Diego. I had barely managed to fund myself to get to races. So she came with me to Innsbruck, Austria for the US team for the Olympics, but she had never actually seen me in a race before that. So I go down the first run of the slalom race, which was the first race. And when I get to the bottom and the times are posted, my time was number one in the world.
Wow.
And so it was an upset. Yeah. Nobody expected me to beat my teammates, never mind anyone else. But I had trained all summer on a glacier. I'd been training with 2-legged skiers and coaches. You know, I had really pushed myself. So here I was, number one in the world. My mother went berserk. You know, my mother was the kind of person who didn't get it about sports. She would say, you know, she would see a jogger go down the street and say, can't they do something constructive with that energy? You know?
Oh. <She didn't get laughs>
So here we are at the Olympics. There's 22 countries represented, over 500 athletes, and I'm number one in my category. And my mother, she just goes berserk. She was jumping up and down. My brother literally rolled her in the snow to cool her off. She was like, you know, jogging, I don't understand, but winning, I like winning, you know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So it takes 2 runs combined time to actually win a medal in skiing. So I had to go back up to the top and wait my turn for the second run. And a few women are going down ahead of me, and they radio back up from the bottom of the course that women are crashing. So you're skiing a different course the second run. There's a really dangerous icy spot on it, and all these women are crashing. One woman was even taken off to the hospital. So I'm at the top thinking, I'm going to die. I used to be really scared, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Right.
But sometimes you're on a course, it's icy, it's steep, it's scary. And, you know, it's people think, are you fearless? No, you're not fearless. I was terrified, but I would go down anyway. And
well, that's good to know.
It happens, you know, in life,
right.
It happens.
Right.
So anyway, I'm on the second run and I'm thinking, no heroics, nothing crazy. I just need to stay standing and I can win the gold if all the other women are falling. So I get out of the gate. going down the hill. You know what? I was sponsored by the National Brotherhood of Skiers. Do you know about the National Brotherhood of Skiers?
I don't know about the National Brotherhood of Skiers.
It's a national black ski organization. You know, you think we don't like cold weather, but there is actually this huge group of black skiers. So they had sponsored me for my training for years, and 44 members of the club came to Innsbruck to cheer me on. So there's this huge crowd of black people screaming on the hill. Kind of stands out, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
My teammate said, "Bonnie, you have a really big family, don't you?"
Of course, they're all my family, yes.
So anyway, so I'm going down on this run for the gold. I can't even hear the people screaming. And I get to where I can see the finish line. And I think, I've made it. I'm over the ice. I'm going to win. What happens when you think all your problems are over? That's when I hit the ice. So I tried to hold onto my edge. As I said, I ski on one leg, couldn't hold onto it, fell down. So I was number one in the world, and now I'm sitting on my butt in the snow. I was so disappointed. I just wanted to like crawl away and not have to face my teammates, my coaches, my sponsors, my family, my mother. But in that split second, my reflexes took over. I grabbed my equipment. I got over the finish line. You know, that's what I'm trained to do.
Right.
And
right.
When the dust cleared and the times were posted, my time was still third. I won the bronze medal, even though I fell and got up, because so many other women on one leg had done the same thing. So I was able to stand on the winner's podium, get the bronze medal put around my neck, my mother sobbing in the snow. But it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't gotten up and finished, even though I didn't feel like it, even though I didn't think I was winning, to get up anyway. So the quote on the Starbucks cup is, "People fall down, winners get up." And sometimes the gold medal winner is just the person who gets up the fastest. Because the woman who won the gold in that race, she also fell. So in the first run, when nothing went wrong, I beat her. I was the better slalom skier.
Right.
In the second run, she beat me not by skiing better, but by getting up faster. So people fall down, winners get up, but sometimes the gold medal winner is just the quicker getter upper, right?
Yeah. You know, and I think that's profound, because I think a lot of times when people fall down, right, falling down in life, you know, when you hit the rough spot, a lot of times people feel like they're the only one who's going through that thing, who's been through that situation. Right. And not that, you know, difficult spots don't, you know, cause us to behave differently than we normally do. But, you know, sometimes we do. We want to sit there and wallow in it. Right.
Right. Well, and it is important to say that sometimes things take time. You know, like when I was healing from the sexual abuse in my childhood, if somebody said, "Hey, just get up and keep going." Actually, my mother said that many times. You got to do the work too. You know,
right.
Some emotional, you know, if somebody's grieving from a death, you don't just say, "Hey, get back up, you know,
hey, get over it." Yeah.
You got to give people time to do their emotional work. But I think getting up faster when you can, you know, like if you lose your job, get back up, or, you know, you go through a divorce, you're not going to be fixed overnight, but, you know, try to exercise, try to, you know, rework on your life. So I don't mean it to be harsh,
but to
the extent that we can get up faster, it does help.
Yeah, it does. It really does. And like I said, there is a certain amount of work sometimes that has to go into just even being able to get up. Right. I think sometimes it's the time that needed to process.
And if you think of that as getting up, then that's good. You engage in the work. And if the work is meditation and prayer and exercise and yoga, or, you know, talking to friends or talking to a therapist, you know, that can be getting up, you know, whereas some people might say, "Oh, that's just, you know, wasting time." So I guess it depends on how you think of getting up.
Right. Right. So thank you so much for sharing that story. It really, I feel like helps us to connect with who you are and where you were in that space and what it takes to win. And so you've written a number of books, right? And you've written a number of books. Which of these has been your favorite to write, and which of them has been the most challenging?
You know, asking an author which book is their favorite is like asking a mother which is her favorite child. You know, that's so unfair, because you put your blood and sinew into each book. And so choosing is hard. Although I will say, I like the books I wrote several books before I wrote How Strong Women Pray, and sort of the ones from How Strong Women Pray afterwards, I like better. Sort of the, I don't know. It's like I reached a certain point where I like the books I write.
Right.
So I wrote How. One way to think of it is sort of past, present, and future. I wrote How Strong Women Pray, and it is about my past because it deals with the abuse and the healing from the abuse. But it's also interviewing 27 women about their prayer lives. And it's not an easy book to read, because if you talk about prayer and how prayer helped you, then it's talking about really difficult times in people's life. But it's a very redemptive narrative. So it's 27 redemptive narratives plus mine. So that's like kind of about the past and the difficult stuff. And then Live Your Joy is very much about the present. And I tell lots of little stories from my life and from other people's lives about finding joy and how do we find more joy in life, no matter what. I kind of wrote that book in answer to how come you're not an axe murderer.
Oh, right.
It's sort of, this is what I've learned about being joyful and staying positive and dreaming big, you know, despite all the things that happened to me. Here's what I've learned. It's a choice. It's an action. It's not just some people are happy and some people aren't, you know, it's a choice to find joy. So then, the book I wrote after that was How Great Women Lead. And I think of that as future. So we have past, present, and this is future, because even in writing the book, when we set out to write the book, the stories hadn't been told yet. So my daughter and I went on a journey, not just to interview women leaders, but to engage with them, to watch them work, to go out and see what they were doing. We went to Maine to a camp where Leslie Lewin brings together kids from war-torn countries and helps them to learn from each other and to gain insights about each other. So Palestinians and Israelis and Jordanians, plus she has Pakistanis and Indians and you know, creating collaboration. So we went to the camp and stayed in the camp and interacted. There's one woman who's an orchestra. There's only one woman who's leading an orchestra in a major U.S. city. We went and watched her rehearse the orchestra and talked to her. So it's it was very much about creating stories that we could write about. And it's also about the future of leadership, because it was a mother-daughter discussion about women leaders and sort of who should she be aspiring to and what should she be learning about leading in the future. So it's interesting. So those books are like past, present, and future to me.
Okay.
And the last one was the hardest to write, and it built on the other ones, because everything we'd learned from writing the other ones went into that book. And creating new stories is obviously harder than just writing about the past.
Right.
So I felt that we were learning and growing.
Right. So, and you've got a new book, right? That's on the horizon.
It is. It's actually, we just recently submitted the manuscript and they put in the pub date, and it's kind of far out there. It's not coming out till February 2017.
Oh, okay.
So we can give people a clue about it, but maybe we'll come back and we'll do another story closer to the time. But that book is the hardest I've ever written. And I think, you know, if you're willing to stretch yourself and keep growing, that's what you do, right? Is you take everything you learned from writing the last book and then you stretch yourself a little further. And this one's about resilience, and there's more science in it. We've been pulling together the research and the insights and the understanding for 5 years and practice delivering it with real people. There's stories of about 20 different real people in the book who've gone through using the techniques that we've learned from the research about resilience. So this one is the most deeply researched book that we've done. And so it's really exciting. And I think it'll make a real big difference for people.
Oh, that's great. And so, yeah, we'll have to have you come back and talk about it as we get closer to its release. So if you could send a message to people, both young and old, about following their dreams, what would that message be?
I think what my life screams out is that more is possible than you can imagine. You know, if a one-legged black girl from San Diego with no money can become an international ski champion, you know, what is possible for you? And I look at like the book we wrote, How Great Women Lead. You look at everybody in that book early in their lives. They could never have imagined where they were going. You know, that if you put a before and after picture at the beginning of Condoleezza Rice's life and later, it's crazy. You know, when she was a little kid, she couldn't even drink out of the same water fountain as other people. And yet her parents convinced her that if you work hard, you study, you have big goals, you can do anything. Nicole Malachowski, when she was growing up, she wanted to be a fighter pilot, but it was illegal for women to be in combat. But she, you know, kept focusing and kept learning and went to the Air Force Academy. And the laws changed while she was there. And she became the first woman Thunderbird pilot. So, I mean, and I could go on and on and on. So much more is possible than we dare to dream. The advice I would give about that is the way I've lived my life is to have a portfolio of dreams. So not just one dream, but I've always had a range of dreams that I'm working on. And I can, it's like an investment portfolio. You put your money in different areas. And if the market changes, you shift, you know, so I'm investing my time, talent, and treasure in different activities. And if something is working, then I'll put more in. And if something is really not working, I'll pull back from it. So it's about having lots of dreams and pursuing what works.
Right. I would agree that it definitely is about having more, you know, having more than one thing you're working on, having more than one dream. And so our time is winding down. But I think we've got time for a couple more questions. What would you say about the state of society today? The refugee crisis, the Black Lives Matter movement.
I actually do a lot of work in corporate America, talking about diversity, inclusion, and how we reach across our differences. And one of the things I've really come to understand recently is that we are wired, our neurological system, you know, the neuroscience tells us that we're actually wired to distrust otherness.
Right.
So people that are different than us, we are for survival in, you know, hunter gatherer days, we distrusted people that didn't look like our tribe. And we have a reaction, you know, cortisol and adrenaline around that. And people who look like us, we secrete oxytocin and warm and fuzzy. So our bodies actually are engaged in that process. And as the world becomes more interconnected, our survival depends on the opposite reaction. That reaction that helped us survive a million years ago is not helping us survive in today's world. And so we have to actively work to retrain ourselves to have more understanding and more collaboration across differences. And what I've come to understand is that thing that I grew up with where people say, oh, well, children don't have that. They all just play together and they don't think about differences. That's not true.
That's not true.
It's factually not true. And there's been a lot of studies in the last 10 years showing that if people don't talk to their children about race, these misunderstandings and fears and differences persist. We actually have to train our children to see collaboration and cooperation across differences. And if we don't, it's at our peril. And there's also a feeling of, well, that work will go away over time. You know, we'll all just, you know, do enough diversity training and then we won't have to do it anymore. No, kids continue to be born with these same fear reactions. And so we will always have to be training ourselves, our people, and our culture to embrace differences and to be inclusive of everyone's talents. And so I guess that's my big insight, is just that this is ongoing work that we all need to be committed to and to figure out how to do in order to overcome the refugee crisis, in order to make Black Lives Matter as much as everyone else's.
Right. And so I think last question, what's the most important lesson that you've learned as you've traveled around the world, sharing your insights and really working to help people recognize, kind of recognize their own humanity as they recognize the humanity of others?
You know, I had an interesting experience last weekend that I think puts this in perspective. Is I got to be on a panel with Liz Gilbert, the author of Eat, Love, Pray.
Right.
And she quoted David White, a poet, about the arrogance of belonging, that we need the arrogance of belonging. And that really struck me because I grew up always feeling like I didn't belong anywhere. I was the oddball. You know, when I found the disabled skiers, I was the black one, you know, and then when I found the black skiers, I was the disabled one. And, you know, it sounds like a joke, but everywhere I went, I was always the oddball and I never fit in. And later in life, there was a turning point where I stopped saying that and I started saying, I belong everywhere. You know, when I'm with the disabled skiers, I'm disabled. When I'm with the black skiers, I'm black. And so sort of focusing on what's common and not what isn't. Right. And I guess it's the arrogance of belonging. It's the acceptance or the chutzpah to say, you know, I fit in and I do, and I claim that, and I have the arrogance of feeling that I belong. And so when you ask about recognizing your own humanity and the humanity of others, it's claiming the arrogance of belonging, but also giving other people the space to claim their own arrogance of belonging. And what Liz Gilbert was talking about, her new book, which just came out called Big Magic, talks about the ability to be creative and do creative work, and that it requires working with fear, that you can't make fear go away. It's what I was talking about earlier. If you're going to do something creative, you are going to be afraid, but being able to push through that, and that the arrogance of belonging is required to be creative. You have to have the audacity to believe that you have the right to be creative, to do something creative, to use your talents, and that all of us need to claim that so that we can put our talents out in the world. And again, I think that's the only way we can save the planet and, you know, not blow each other up is to be able to find our humanity and the humanity of others.
Bonnie, thank you so much for being willing to come on the show today and share with us so much about your life and your personal experiences. Thank you for just uplifting and edifying all of us today with your words.
Oh, well, thank you. And thanks for all you do. And I look forward to coming back when we can have another conversation.
Yeah, I look forward to it. Thank you so much, Bonnie.
Thanks, Michelle. Have a great day.
You too.